guy just said today, I think leaving early tomorrow.
Yeah, let me change.
So you have to get in with your questions early. He's going to tell us about stability walls in Petrarch 2.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me here. It's always a pleasure to come. So I'm going to be talking about some work I've done with Laura Anderson and Bert Otterick, who are in Penn, and Andre Lucas, who's in Oxford, same as me. And his work's appeared in two papers, these archive numbers. And what these are is essentially one long paper with all the mathematical details and then a short letter where we just sort of extract the physics of it. Because all we're going to be doing in this talk is linking some algebraic geometry to field theory, essentially. And I really want to mention before I start some earlier work on the topic I'm going to talk about by Eric Sharp. So I'm going to be working on Calabria free folds, but Eric Sharp had a paper a long time ago which had many of the qualities of details of what I'm going to describe in the case of K3, which is somewhat different but has a lot of overlap, so that's really worth mentioning. So if I'm going to talk about stability walls in heterotic theories, I probably ought to start by reminding you at least of what a heterotic theory is and then tell you about what a stability wall is. And so that's what I'll start with. And please interrupt me at any time throughout. I mean, I'd much rather you guys concentrate on what you're interested in than necessarily getting through everything I've got. Okay. So the context I'm going to be working in is heterotic M theory. And I'm going to use the strongly coupled language of the heterotic string like this for a reason that you'll see towards the end of the talk, but just to remind people what the strongly coupled description of the EA looks like. So we start with the Javert-Witten theory, which is the strongly coupled limit of the EA heterotic superstring
at low energy. What this theory is it's an 11-dimensional theory, the bulk of which is just gravity. So you've got 11-dimensional supergravity essentially in direction. And then one direction is not infinite. You're on an S1 over Z2 orbifold or a line interval. And at either end of the line interval, you have a 10-dimensional orbifold fixed plane or end plate. And on each end plate, you find that, essentially by anomaly cancellation, you find that you have to have one copy of V8 super Yang nils. So we have an 11-dimensional gravitational theory with an orbifold fixed plane at either end with one copy of V8 super Yang nils on each end. And then there's a whole bunch of other things that you can add to this theory as well, but they're not really going to be too important for me today, so I'm not going to spend too much time on them. One thing you can add is M-theory's M5 frames in the bulk. These are nice because I'm going to hide some more dimensions in a minute and get a 4D theory, and these can be added in such a way that you preserve the supersymmetry of the 4D theory. Implicitly, everything I'm going to say is going to include these, and you'll see them appearing towards the end, but they're not too much of an important point for today, so you can by and large ignore them. What I'm explicitly not going to include is anti-brain. So there's also anti-brains that could be included in the vacuum, but they would break the supersymmetry of the 4D theory. And a lot of what I'm going to say leans heavily on supersymmetry, so this explicitly does not apply to that case. Okay, so one dimension out of 11 is already compact, of course, so we need to get down to four dimensions, we need to compact by six more. That statement's a little bit misleading, but I'm going to choose to compactify the remaining six on a Calabi-Yau threefold. And so I have this four space times Calabi-Yau threefold, and it's a warp product with this S1 over Z2 orbifold. And you may say, well, is that just the end of the story? Can I just compactify heterotic on a Calabi-Yau on this line interval and get a 4D theory and just leave it at that? And unfortunately, in heterotic, that's not the end of the story. And that's not the end of the story, essentially, because of some magnetic charges that appear in the theory. So if I work in 10 dimensions, so integrate out the line interval, in the 10-dimensional theory, you have the Nevers-Schwarz 2 form, and it has a field strength H. And this field strength doesn't have dH equals 0, the usual Bianchi identity. It has magnetic charges. So there's, if you like, some positive-type charges that come from the two gauge fields. We've got two E8 factors, which is one and the other. And it has some negative charges, at least, symmetric coming from the curvature of the manifold itself. And the basic problem, the reason you can't just compactify heterotic on some curved manifold and leave it at that, is that on any compact manifold, the sum of the charges for any field have to add up to zero, essentially because there's nowhere for the field lines to go. You've got a source, you've got to have an associated sink. And mathematically, the way you see that is if you take this Bianchi identity and you integrate it over a four cycle, any four cycle, this thing's going to give zero because it's an exact form. And I'll pick up terms from these pieces. So I get an integrability condition on the Bianchi identity that looks like this just by integrating it. And this essentially says that the sum of the charges from the gauge sector for this magnetic charges for this H field have to be the equal to the sum of the charges coming from the curvature of the manifold. The problem is that for a Calabi-Yau space, this term is not zero, which means these terms can't be zero either. In other words, in the vacuum, you have to have expectation values for the gauge field. You've not got a choice. So obviously, if you're going to choose vacuum expectation values for gauge fields, you want to choose their index to lie in the internal direction so you don't break for the Poincaré invariance. You also have to satisfy this constraint, but how else are you going to choose the gauge fields? What other criteria are you going to put on them? Well, you choose them in the same way you chose the compactification manifold. You demand that the gauge fields preserve supersymmetry. And if you look at the Gaugino variation for the super Yang-Mills fields living on the brain, you find that the equations that the gauge fields have to satisfy if they're going to preserve supersymmetry are these ones. And these are rather sloppily called the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations. So these A and B indices are holomorphic indices on the Calabi-Yau A bar B bar, anti-holomorphic indices. So it's just FAB, FA bar, B bar equals zero, which doesn't depend on the metric. But then there's this also this equation which says that the metric contraction with the field strength of the gauge fields has got to be zero. And you get one of those for each EA factor. So we choose our gauge fields to satisfy supersymmetry and this charge condition. And then we just compactify the theory. So we find a background that's a Calabi-Yau with this S1 over Z2 orbifold, appropriate gauge fields. We plug the background into the higher dimensional action, essentially just integrate out the extra dimensions and get a 4D action. So the gauge field VEVs that you've put, say, choose one E8 factor and look at that one. The gauge field VEVs that you've put in that E8 factor will break some of the E8. Just a standard Higgs effect, but with a gauge field. So if you choose, for example, gauge field VEVs to lie in SU3, then you will break E8 in the 4D theory down to the commutant of SU3 inside E8. It's just like using an adjoint Higgs. So in particular, if you choose the gauge group of the vector bundle, so in other words, if you choose the gauge group that the VEVs lie into the SU3, SU4, or SU5, you will get an E6, an SO10, or an SU5 gut in four dimensions respectively, just from the breaking they induce. You get matter from the dimensional reduction of the rest of the gauge sector. And you get a bunch of moduli, as usual, from, well, one way of thinking of it is from integration constants in your initial solution for the metric and the gauge. This will give gap theories, and that's all I'm going to talk about today. Of course, eventually, many people want to break that down to the standard model, and to do that, you have to use Wilson lines, perhaps quotient or manifold if it doesn't have a non-trivial point one. That won't be. Yeah. So once you can compactify things in any order mathematically, and once you've compactified the interval, there is absolutely no difference. There's just a few numbers in there that's different. So you may say, why on earth did I bother putting up this diagram with the brains? But I did that to remind you of that because there's a point later on where the fact that there is this extra dimension will be important to me. But by the time you get down to four dimensions, the only difference is some numerical values for, you know, you basically get Newton's constant right, or you can do, and that's the only change. No, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, from the matter, obviously, if you were physically looking at different energy scales, at which theory was the appropriate one, then the relative size, say, of the Calabi-Yau and the interval would be important. But if you're actually just doing the mathematics of compactification, once you go down to four dimensions, it doesn't make any difference if you do the S1 over Z2 and then the Calabi-Yau or the Calabi-Yau. So everything I'm saying applies to both. It's just that one thing later on is easier to see in the story of the language.
Transformations, and that precisely characterized by parameters which you just mentioned, which involve ratios of distance of interval and Calabi-Yau frame. So you really have to tune those to be small. You cannot take them arbitrary.
So everything I will do will be in the usual expansions of Petrosian theory. There will be corrections. I will discuss those explicitly towards the end of the talk.
So the usual expansions of heterotic N theory are called epsilon S and epsilon R. They're the essentially size of the warping across the interval and something that controls modes in the Calabi-Yau, alpha prime and string couplings in the weakly coupled theory. Everything's done in an expansion of those. There are corrections of various types, and we'll see them, and they'll play an important part. And that's, in fact, why I've described things in strongly coupled language. So the catch with all of this, anyway, I'll get into proper details in a minute. The catch with all of this is that, except perhaps numerically these days, you don't know the Calabi-Yau metric. And you're not going to know it as a function of the moduli, even numerically. If you don't know the metric, and this is the equation you have to solve for the gauge fields, you don't know the gauge fields either, because you don't know what the equation is. Yeah, that's called, you can pick the gauge fields to be related to the connection of the metric, it's called the standard embedding. But I'm specifically not going to do that today because the standard embedding gives a bundle that's stable everywhere and it's not going to display the structure. Everything I'm talking about today is cases where you don't do that. The standard embedding is very nice. It's just, let me explain. In the next slide, I'll show you the phenomenon that doesn't occur in the standard embedding. Essentially, the standard embedding is supersymmetric. Okay, so we can't describe the Calabi-Yau and the gauge fields explicitly, so we use algebraic geometry to describe the situation. So just to answer these questions about the standard embedding, what is it I'm going to be talking about today? Well, I blithely said that you pick your gauge fields to be supersymmetric. But that statement depends on the metric. Those equations for the supersymmetry of the gauge field depended on the metric. And given that, the statement depends on the Taylor moduli. So I'm going to illustrate everything today in terms of an example, but the proofs I will give you, the proofs I will describe are in fact completely general. I'll describe exactly how general later on. But the example I'm going to take has two Kähler moduli. I'm going to call them S1 and S2. These are actually slightly dual variables to the usual Kähler moduli, but you can think of them that way. And the Kähler moduli space of this model that I'm going to describe, the Kähler cone is just this colored region. So if you go to the line at slope of half, you get a flop in the Calabi-Yau. You vary in Kähler moduli space here, and all of this region is perfectly allowed, and something nasty happens at this axis as well. And you can't get too close to the edge. And it turns out, for a specific example I'm going to give you later on, that when you're in this region of the Kähler moduli space, the metric on the Calabi-Yau is such that you can find a solution for the topology of gauge fields that I'm going to choose here. You can find a solution such that the gauge fields are supersymmetric. So here you can solve the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations, and everything's fine. But if you vary the Kähler moduli, so you go into this region, it turns out that these equations, the metric changes so that these equations no longer have a solution. You cannot have supersymmetric gauge fields once you get into this region.
You
can't. There is no solution to this.
So what do you normally do in heterotic? Well, you do the usual physicist approach, you ignore this bit. So normally in heterotic, what you do is you work in this region where the fields are supersymmetric, and you know, if you see people building standard models, or if you see people doing ekpyrotic cosmology or whatever, they're normally working in this region. However, you can just vary the fields physically and get into this region. So the question comes, what happens when you do that? You know you break supersymmetry, but more precisely, what happens? So why am I not considering the standard embedding? Because this never happens in the standard embedding. In the standard embedding, you can always get supersymmetric solutions everywhere.
Sorry, I
can
just tell us that there are no solutions.
Yeah, this is a specific example. So you have to choose two things. You have to choose the topology of your manifold and the topology of your gauge field. This is a manifold and the gauge field topology choice, which I'll present explicitly later on. And it's not a standard embedding choice, and so it has these two regions. If I'd chosen the gauge field topology different so that it was a standard embedding choice, you would find that this unstable region did not appear. The standard model is, the standard embedding is stable. We will see that later on. Essentially, it's going to be zero at the boundary and increase as you go into the unstable region. But let me derive the theory, and then you'll see that actually coming out explicitly. So that's the next slide. Good. So we know that supersymmetry is going to be broken here. What else is going to happen? Well, one thing that, in fact, you know from various theorems in CFT that's going to happen is there has to be a potential in the unstable region. So you can actually see that very easily. So if we look at the 10-dimensional action of heterotic. It has a couple of bits in it that I've just cherry-picked because they give me the answer, they show you the bit I want to show you. So you have trace F squared for the 2E8 gauge fields and minus trace R squared. And you can dimensionally reduce this to get a potential. So the working looks like this. Here's our Bianchi identity. I'm going to wedge that up with the Kähler form, J, and I'm going to integrate it over the manifold. J wedge DH integrated gives zero, and so the right-hand side gives me this part. Now, I'm going to make some assumptions, which aren't made in the rest of the talk, but just for this bit. And that's going to be, I'm going to assume I start in the supersymmetric region with a nice supersymmetric configuration. In particular, I'm going to satisfy these equations. And then I'm going to change only the Kähler moduli to go into the non-supersymmetric region. In particular, I'm going to keep the other moduli, like the complex structure and the bundle moduli, fixed. Now, these equations, which are initially zero, do not depend on the Kähler moduli. So they're going to carry on being satisfied, and this one is going to change. And if I make that assumption, and I use some usual Calabi-Yau stuff, I can rewrite this expression like this. And the point of doing that rewriting is these first three terms here are what appears in the action. So I can just substitute this in, and for these configurations, the action looks like that. And that's exactly what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk, but just for this simple case, I want to ask what the potential looks like if I just vary in one direction into the field space. In the rest of the talk, you're going to see that this approach is not useful. In the rest of the talk, I will do everything at arbitrary points in field space. That's exactly right. It's not a modulus, and that's all I want to show with this argument. Yeah, so in fact, they would be moduli in the sense that they have no potential, only in the light blue region at the bottom, and then they would pick up a potential as you go into the other region. If you ignored the gauge fields, there'd be potentials everywhere, moduli everywhere. They're actually fields in the 4D theory that have a certain potential, and the goal of this talk is going to be to derive that potential precisely. But they're only flat in the region, and the way you see that is exactly this. So this is a potential.
The idea is
that you take these things to be functions of the moduli fields. So F is a function of the bundle moduli, G is a function of the Kähler moduli. You would plug in your solution, say you knew the solution to the Calabi-Yau. You would plug it in, you would integrate out 6 of the 10 dimensions and get a 4D theory. Right? And then this thing, because it contains no 4D derivatives, should give you some kind of potential for those moduli. It's a sort of qualitative discussion. But these terms here that appear in this expression are exactly the terms that are forced to zero by supersymmetry. So if you have a supersymmetric configuration, if you're in the light blue region, both of these terms are zero, and this doesn't give a potential. And that's why you don't normally see this discussed in heterotics. Because normally you're working in the supersymmetric region, and this just gives zero. However, if you break the supersymmetry, and this is non-zero, you pick up a positive definite potential. It's a sum of squares. So what happens in this diagram, you only have moduli here. And what happens is as you go along this flat direction, everything's fine. But when you get here and try to go into this region, there is a potential that sweeps up. Now, the goal of this talk is going to be to answer questions like, what's the scale of that potential? What does it look like? And in particular, this is completely and utterly useless for them. I just did this to try and show you that there would be a potential there. But I don't know F and I don't know G in terms of the moduli, so I can't plug in F and G, do a dimensional reduction, and give you the potential as a function of the fields. What I want to do is give you a potential as a function of the fields so you can use it practically for rolling around or moduli stabilization or whatever. And that's what I'm going to do for the rest of the talk. But because that's going to get somewhat technical, I'm going to tell you the answer right at the start. So the answer is that this potential I'm talking about is a D term. The technical thing to show you in this talk is going to be that as you vary in Kähler moduli space and hit the line between where the gauge fields are supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric, an extra U1 appears in the low energy gauge group. So we will see an extra abelian gauge field appearing in 4D at the boundary between these two regions. That extra U1 has a D term. And it looks like this. This is looks like a mess, but all it is a field-dependent Fi term and the usual contribution to a D term from charged matter. There's going to be some charged matter that I'll call C, and as usual, that contributes minus QC squared. The only thing that's slightly different is there's a non-canonical metric in there. But this is some positive definite metric times the usual contribution to a D term from charged matter. And this Fi term is a function of the Kähler modulus. And it's negative in the supersymmetric region, positive in the non-supersymmetric region, and zero in the line between. And what happens is when you're in the supersymmetric region, you find that all of the charges for these C fields are negative. So this is a positive definite term. When you're in the supersymmetric region, this is negative. There's a negative Fi term. But by giving BEVs to C fields, I can get a positive contribution from the second term. I can cancel the Fi term, and I can get D equals zero. So in the supersymmetric region, I get a field theory, the D term of which can vanish. So I preserve supersymmetry in 4D theory, and the potential, which is just D squared, is also zero. But when you go into this non-supersymmetric region, the sign of this Fi term, which I'm going to derive, flips and becomes positive. This is a negative charge, so this is a positive definite term. This is a positive term. There's no way you can adjust the two terms to cancel each other. And you will find that the D term is necessarily non-zero in that region. You've broken supersymmetry in the 4D theory. That's how it manifests itself in the 4D theory as a D term breaking. And the square of that gives you the potential, which will be precisely a function of the field that's given by this thing squared. That's a very good question. So you can't always cancel, and we give mathematical lemmas that say when and when you can't in the paper. And they're proved in sufficient generality, for example, that they don't even assume a bundle construction. So if someone discovers a new way of constructing vector bundles, there's a set of conditions of what are called X groups for when this will happen and when it won't. I'm going to show you a case where it doesn't happen towards the end of the talk and explain what that means physically, and it's something else. So there's all these different cases that can happen. I'm showing you this one first, where you only get one sign of charge because it's the simplest case. And I'll show you the other one later on, and it will correspond to transitioning between different vector bundles. It can happen either way, but this specific example that I'm showing you now, for example, only has one sign of charge, and so let me discuss that one for now. Depends how you define moduli, right? I mean, if you define them in the strict sense that they might. They survive in the four-dimensional theory as long as the potential doesn't become greater than the compactification scale. Yeah, so in the supersymmetric region, everything's flat and fine. And what's going to happen is as you start to move into the non-supersymmetric region, at first, there's a potential for them, but it's small, and it's sort of pushing you back into the supersymmetric region. But of course, once that potential gets too big, once it reaches the compactification scale, you can't trust it anymore. And so you lose control of the theory. And in fact, once you get that far into the non-supersymmetric region, there is no 4D theory. You'd have to describe it in high dimension. Yes, you do. So in this, what you have, we have a supersymmetric 4D theory, which is valid, say, between that line and that line. This is where the potential starts at zero and smoothly goes up, and it becomes the compactification scale here. So, sure. It does, but that's part of the theory, right? I mean, it's just the potential that's pushing you back into the region, and that's what I want to derive. So in the same way, if you added flux, flux on its own will often give you a runaway. So you keep the field in the 4D theory. And then you may try and add other effects to something to try and balance you. Make a minimum. It's going to be a very similar thing. So the way you keep it under control is you use the usual expansion parameters of either the weakly coupled or the strongly coupled string. You make sure that actually in this case the theory has a supersymmetric vacuum because I put it in there. You can come up with theories that won't have a supersymmetric vacuum by choosing different topologies of the gauge field, but I'm not going to show you an example of that. I think, you know, I haven't, so our derivation only holds while the four-dimensional theory I'm going to show you is valid, which is sort of up to here somewhere. We in the letter, we characterize exactly how far you can trust it. But I think because the energy density of the potential becomes larger than the compactification scale when you get out here, there probably isn't even a 4D theory, right? No, you're right. You're right. So there must be.
It must be that it's just in the Grandjean, it's not super small.
It's just not a
supergravity, but it's. Yeah, I suppose that must be true. I mean,
today all I'm going to show you is the Lagrangian that's valid in this region where the potential is. Because that's the only place that. That's a good point. That's what the rest of the talk's going to be about. I've just told you. And, I mean, at the moment, I'm asking you to trust me, and there's no reason why you should. So, what I have to do for the rest of the talk is explain exactly where this U1 comes from. Derive this D-term from first principles, and then show you it does everything I've just told you.
People like Anne, your angle example, done. And as I said, Eric Sharp has done things that are very similar on K3 and heterotic. But we've done it with more generality, and we've fleshed out general lemmas for when this happens, and we've also got you from long.
The other one is mentioned of pi stability.
Yeah, I'll mention corrections for stability later on. I'm not going to mention pi stability because that's very much a type 2 thing. I mean, you'd expect it to be correction. I'll mention corrections later on when I do play a role. So,
as was mentioned, so far all I've done is said, trust me, I look trustworthy. So I have to really explain where this U1 comes from and then derive the rest. And that's what the rest of the talk's going to be about. And to do that, I have to start doing things properly, which means I have to introduce a bit of algebraic geometry. So the way the gauge fields are dealt with in algebraic geometry of heterotic compactifications is through vector bundle stability. And so there's going to be a few slides of pain where I go through what we need of that. But then it's all about getting this U1 out. And once we've got this U1 out, things become nicer again. So let me start by talking a bit about vector bundle stability and how it applies to heterotic. Well, it enters the subject through the theorem of Donaldson, Uhlenbeck, and Yao. And what Donaldson, Uhlenbeck, and Yao say is that for each polystable holomorphic vector bundle, there exists a unique connection satisfying commission Yang-Mills. Now, I should be careful here, just for people that are experts. It's not actually commission Yang-Mills that's relevant to physics. It's commission Yang-Mills with slope zero. So there's an extra criterion on there, but this will do. So if I'm going to explain what this means, I better explain what a polystable holomorphic vector bundle is. It's a Green-Schwarz anomalous U1, if that's what you mean. So the fact that all those charges were the same means that U1 is clearly anomalous. And in fact, it's the Green-Schwarz anomalous U1. It's not quite. I'm going to explain exactly why it appears as we go along. I mean, you can still construct a bundle, it's not stable, but it's more to do with what happens on the line than what happens in that funny region. Okay, so the idea anyway is that there is this object in algebraic geometry, this polystable holomorphic vector bundle, and it's in one-to-one correspondence with supersymmetric solutions for the gauge field. So instead of looking for supersymmetric solutions for the gauge field, you look for this object. And I better should tell you what this object is. To define stability, which appears here, you need to define slope. And the idea of slope is this. If you give a sheaf or a bundle, then what slope does is it takes your sheaf and it gives you a number. So say I've got my sheaf or bundle V. The slope of that sheaf or bundle is a number that's given by 1 over its rank. So if I've got SU3 gauge fields, it's 1 over 3. Times by the integral of the first Chern class wedged up with enough powers of the Kähler form to be integrated over the Calabi Yau. So in our case, the first Chern class here will be some two-form associated, a topological number, two-form associated to the bundle, the gauge fields, essentially it's the integral of the trace of the field string, wedged up with two powers of the Kähler form to get a sixth form which I can integrate over the Calabi Yau. So it's just some integral, you give it your sheaf, you give it your bundle, it gives you a number. And a bundle V is said to be stable if all subsheaves, so that's all sub-objects, sheaves that inject into the bundle, all sub-pieces of the bundle, have slope less than that of the bundle itself. Now, we're going to be interested in SUN bundles, so the slope of the bundle turns out to be zero, the first churn class vanishing. So what this says is that a bundle is stable if all its sub-pieces, if all the sub-sheaves, have negative slope, so that the sub-pieces have slope less than the bundle itself. So you have some mathematical object, a bundle, you check all its sub-pieces, and if they all have negative slope, then the thing has a supersymmetric solution. If one of them, say, has a positive slope, then there is no supersymmetric solution. That's the statement of Donaldson and Bekenyau. In fact, that's not quite the statement, because they don't say stable here. They say polystable. And this is just an irritating technicality, which is unfortunately important for us. A bundle is polystable if it is a sum of stable pieces, all with the same slope. And this is just a really irritating caveat, which is that if I have one solution to Hermitian-Yang-Mills, and then I have another solution to Hermitian-Yang-Mills that commutes with the first, if I add them together, the equations are linear, and I get a new solution. So that's this. You're just adding together solutions. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you can think of it that way. I mean, if you like, it's just two commuting pieces, the solutions to the gauge field equations in the hidden dimension. So what do I do? Well, I showed you this diagram at the beginning. Sorry. That's what I'm going to give you today. Yeah. It's the FI term in the detail. So there are two notions of stability. So there's moduli stability. Do you have a minimum? That's nothing whatsoever to do with this. And the notation's not my fault. I'm sorry. This stability, which is pretty much the only one I'll talk about today, is do you have a supersymmetric solution to your gauge field equation? Yeah, I know. It's a pain. So I had this diagram at the beginning that looked like this, where I claim to you, I have supersymmetric gauge field solutions here, but not here. How did I get that? Well, I actually worked out the stability of this bundle by computing subsheaves and working out their slope. And just to show you that there's an explicit example behind this, this is what it looks like. So this is the Calabi-Yau I was working on. It's called the 2-4. It's a complete intersection Calabi-Yau, and it's defined. You take a direct product of P1 and P3, two projective spaces, and then you have a polynomial, the zeros of which inside that space are the Calabi-Yau. And this is the polynomial. It's degree 2 in the homogeneous coordinates of the P1, and it's degree 4 in the homogeneous coordinates of the P3. This is just one way of defining a particular Calabi-Yau manifold for our example. So that's our Calabi-Yau, and this thing is the bundle I was talking about. So what does this mean? Well, first of all, everything here, these entries, are all bundles. And if you look at this one, for example, this is a line bundle. It's a rank one bundle, would have an abelian gauge field on it. And rank one bundles, line bundles, are specified on Calabi-Yau, at least by their first churn class. First churn class, this thing has H11 equals 2, with the Kähler forms descending from P1 and P3. The first churn class is an expansion, can be written as a number times an expansion in the basis of your 1-1 forms. So it's specified by two numbers. So for example, this line bundle is the line bundle whose first churn class is 2 times the Kähler form of P1 plus 1 times the Kähler form of P3. So there's just some way of uniquely specifying line bundles by this topological property. So I've got a sum of 4 line bundles here. This is some rank 4 bundle that's just 4 line bundles stacked next to each other. I have a rank 1 bundle here, just a single line bundle. And this guy is going to be my final object. This is the bundle that I'm building out of the other pieces. So all I need to tell you now is what these arrows mean, and what this is called a short exact sequence, and what this means. So all of these arrows are maps between bundles. So this is some map that takes you from this set of 4 line bundles into this 1 line bundle. And this sequence being short exact means that the image of this map is the kernel of this map, the image of this map is the kernel of this map, and so on. So what does this first part of the diagram mean? Naught goes to V goes to this sum of line bundles. Well, the kernel of the map from V into this sum of line bundles is the image of this map, which is 0. So what this first part means is you're just what's called injecting V into this sum of line bundle. So V is living intact and whole somewhere inside this sum of line bundles. This piece just tells you exactly how. So the image of this map that puts V inside this sum of line bundles is the kernel of this map F. So in other words, I've got a map between two sums of line bundles, things that I know how to construct, and the kernel of that map is the bundle I'm talking about. So this is a bit technical. If you're not familiar with this stuff, don't worry about it. I just wanted to show you with this slide that there is explicitly a bundle behind the pictures I'm showing you. This is specifying the topology of the gauge field configuration. I'm not just making it up. So you do your stability analysis. You look at subsheafs of this bundle. To do all of this, you need control of the cohomology of these line bundles. But fortunately, on this kind of space, we have that. And you look for subsheaves with negative slope, positive slope, and try and look at when this bundle is going to be stable. And that we did that. And for this bundle, you find that in this region, all of the subsheaves, which are part of the bundle, all of the constituents, have negative slope. And so the bundle is stable, and there's a supersymmetric gauge field configuration. But there is one subsheaf who's a part of the bundle with a negative slope here, but its slope changes. And as you go here, its slope becomes zero. And as you go here, its slope becomes positive. So this one piece ruins everything once you cross this line at slope one. It's, first of all, its slope is zero, negative, so it doesn't break supersymmetry. It becomes zero. Then it becomes positive. And as soon as it does, it breaks the stability of the bundle. So that's the origin of this diagram. Very good. Yeah, actually it does. Yeah. I'm just about to explain whether you want to come to them now. So I'm getting it. Well, it's on the 2-4. It's a bundle on the 2-4 club, yeah. So it's a these are line bundles actually on the club, yeah, not on the hypersets, because I've already coded them down. So these are the... I see. Sorry. I see. That's a good question. So this Calabi-Yau is this hypersurface in the ambient space. And for this Calabi-Yau, it has a particular property, which is that it's what's called favorable. That means its Kähler forms, there's just two of them, and they descend from the Kähler forms of the ambient space. So they just pull down. So when you're right, I've been sloppy. So when I write 2-1, what I actually mean is take the Kähler form of the P1, pull it to the Calabi-Yau. Take the Kähler form of the P3, pull it to the Calabi-Yau. You've got two of the first one. Great. Thank you. Okay. So we're getting there. Right? So you know the things supersymmetric in this region. You know the things non-supersymmetric in this region. To see this extra U1, we have to ask what happens actually on the line between them. Is the system supersymmetric on this line, or does it break supersymmetry? Well, we know that there's this subsheaf, I'm going to call it F, whose slope becomes zero precisely on that line. So we know that there's a subsheaf F, it's actually rank 2 in this case, which injects into and has the same slope as V. Now, if you go back to our definition of stability, F is not allowed to have the same slope as V. It has to be less. So this bundle is not stable. However, the condition for supersymmetry is polystability. So there's a get-out clause. If the bundle splits into two pieces, F plus something else, both with the same slope, you can preserve supersymmetry. And so what we have to decide is, can it split like that? And it turns out that's very easy. You write that, so we want to see, can V split into F plus K? If you can, you preserve supersymmetry. If not, you break supersymmetry. V's got a moduli space of bundles, a bundle moduli space, which is essentially choices in defining the maps. Find it. Can you tune the moduli so that it splits into two? Well, we know F injects into V, which allows me to write that part of the sequence by analogous arguments to the ones I made defining V. And these coherent sheaves are what's called an abelian category, which just means that you can always stick something there to make this a short exact sequence. So you're allowed to write down this just from the fact that something is mucking the thing up. something is destabilizing the line of logic. And once you've written down that, then lots of clever mathematicians help you out. So this is called defining a bundle by extension. There's a moduli space for the bundle if you define it in this way. And there's just a theorem in Griffiths and Harris that says if you can write this for a bundle, there is always a point in its moduli space where V splits up into two pieces. For people who've dealt with bundles, the moduli space of this thing is an X group, and it always has a zero. So when you get to this line, so the thing's supersymmetric in the stable region, in the lower region, it's non-supersymmetric in the upper region, and on the line between them, it can be supersymmetric, but the bundle has to rip in two. So what does that actually mean physically? The bundle's describing your gauge field bevels. Say you want to preserve supersymmetry. As you approach this line, the bundle has to rip in two, and what that means for the gauge field bevels, they're initially valued in SU3, but as this thing rips in two, that means that the gauge field bevels are now valued in S of U2 times U1. It changes the structure group of the bundle. What this means is you'll get, this group is unitary matrices in two dimensions and a phase, such that the determinant of the unitary matrix is 1 over the phase. Locally, this is the same as SU2 times U1. So what's happening, to preserve supersymmetry, the gauge fields are getting ripped apart when you approach the line. Their VEVs are changing from SU3 to SU2 times U1. But the commutant of those VEVs is what gives you the 4D gauge theory, right? So for example, the commutant in E8 of SU3 gave me E6, which is why this type of heterotic model had that type of gut group in the first place. But if I change the gauge field VEVs like this, the commutant is no longer E6 because U1 commutes itself. The commutant in E8 of this thing is E6 times U1. And that's why the extra U1 appears. So that's the end of the technical section. It was all there just to get this extra U1. But does anyone have any questions?
It goes on as massless on the line only, and it gets a mass on the line?
It's Green-Schwarz anomalous, so it has, we'll see this later on, but it has a Green-Schwarz mass on the line, which is below the compactification scale. We'll see it getting Higgs as you go away from the line.
So it's never massless?
It's never completely massless. The question is whether it's below. Yeah. If it was massless, you wouldn't get that FI term.
No, sorry, but in the line, the S-line term is 0.
On the boundary. Yeah, on the boundary, the FI term is 0, but we're going to, I haven't actually shown you. You're going to see that the axion, the Kähler module axion, is actually the shift symmetry is gauged under this U1. So if you write down its kinetic term, because it's a shift symmetry gauging, the covariant derivative is D of field plus constant times gauge field. If you square that kinetic term, you get a mass of the gauge field. So there's a mass for the gauge field not coming from the D term, but actually coming from, on the line, coming from the gauge field, the kinetic term of the Kähler module. We'll see that.
Okay. This is like having the Biwa shift, but not the...
So why on earth did I go through all that rubbish? So I went through that to get the U1, and the reason I wanted the U1 is how I'm going to derive this effective theory with the potential. What I'm now going to do is I'm going to work on this line between where the gauge fields are supersymmetric and where they break supersymmetry. And I'm going to sit at that line, include this extra U1, and I'm going to do the dimensional reduction for the theory that to get a supersymmetric theory on that line. And when you do a dimensional reduction, it describes small fluctuations about the solution you compactified on. So I'm going to fluctuate slightly into the supersymmetric region, and I better reproduce the usual results. And then I'm going to fluctuate, once it does, and we trust it, we're going to fluctuate slightly into the non-supersymmetric region, and that's where we're going to see the effective field theory coming in. Okay. So how do I do that? Well, if I'm going to tell you what an effective theory is, we're back to field theory now. If I'm going to tell you what an effective theory is, I better tell you what its matter content is. There's two types of matter content. There's that coming from the gauge fields and that coming from the gravitational sector. Let me do the gauge fields first and then the gravitational sector. I start with an E8 gauge group and adjoint matter in that E8 gauge group. And I do the usual group theory. I'm breaking to E6 times SU2 times U1. I do the usual group theory to break that up to see what matter can possibly arise in the theory. So this is an E6 charge representation, this is an SU2, and this is a U1 charge. That doesn't tell you what matter actually does arise in the theory. To do that, you have to work out zero modes of the appropriate Dirac operators in the internal space. And that's done for us by computing various bundle cohomologies. So if you work out using the usual techniques, but working on this split point where there's this extra U1, if you work out what fields you have, you find you have 16 fields, which are singlets under E6 and have a charge minus 3 under VU1. You have a charge, 7 fields which are completely chargeless, both under E6 and U1. And you have 2 fields that are families of E6, the 27s of E6, with a negative charge under VU1. So this is some of the structure that I mentioned at the beginning. You see that all of the fields that appear either have negative charges or they have a zero charge. There's no positively charged field under this extra U1. What physically are these fields? Well, the 27 fields are unambiguously matter. They're families of E6. These guys, which are just uncharged fields descending from the gauge sector, are unambiguously moduli, they're bundle moduli. So these guys, which are not charged under E6, are charged under U1, are more interesting. So they're charged under U1, so you'd probably normally call them matter. But in actual fact, it's easier to think of them as bundle moduli. And the reason for that is this. Our bundle is split into two pieces. We've got V is equal to F plus K. And normally, the thing you call bundle moduli in a heterotic compactification is H1 V tensor V star. If I do V tensor V star, K is a line bundle, so K tensor K star is the trivial bundle. F tensor K star, F star tensor K, F star tensor F star. You take H1 of that, and this is the stuff you would normally call the bundle moduli. Now this chap is exactly this guy, and that's exactly what I was calling bundle moduli a minute ago. But these extra fields that I'm talking about now, these F tensor K star guys, are also in there. And so in that sense, they're bundle moduli. And you can ask physically, what do they correspond to? Well, I'm going to call these fields C from now on. When their VEV is zero, the bundle is split into its two pieces. If I give them a VEV, the bundle starts to mix back together into one whole thing. They're the moduli that went to zero to allow the thing to break into two pieces in the first place. And that's all the matter coming from the gauge fields. And then you just do the usual reductions to get the matter coming from the gravitational sector. And you get all the stuff that we know and love. Kähler moduli, dilaton, M5 frame position moduli, complex structure, they all come as usual. The only slight difference here, and this is related to the question Fernando was raising, is that one of the Kähler moduli are charged under this extra U1. So the imaginary part of the Kähler moduli, which I'm going to call chi, as usual, is a dimensional reduction of the free form of M theory, and this thing transforms under gauge transformation. And if you work out what that means, for our U1, the axion, the Kähler axion that has this shift symmetry, the shift symmetry of the Kähler axion has been gauged by this U1. So all of this stuff is just a constant times the gauge transformation parameter. So the Kähler axion's gauge shift symmetry has been gauged. Of course, there's two Kähler parameters, so there's two shift symmetries to gauge. So which combination gets gauged? Well, that's determined by the first Jern class of our destabilizing object. So that's it. We've got all our gauge matter, we've got our gravitational matter, and you now just plug it into the formula in Wessenbagger to work out what the 4D contributions do. So our 4D theory is n equals 1 supersymmetric. The potential has, therefore, D terms and F terms, and that's it. It turns out in this case, if you allow me to be a bit sloppy, that the F terms are all zero, and that's because everything had the same U1 charge, so I can't write down invariant superpotential. So the only thing that's important here is the D terms. That's the only thing in this case that are non-zero. And you get one D term, of course, for each generator in the gauge group. So we get some for E6, and we get some for our extra U1. Now, I only had 27s and no 27 bars of E6. So if you work out what the E6 D term tells you, it just tells you that the VEV of all your 27 fields, all your matter fields, is zero in vacuum. So I'm just going to set them all to zero, ignore it from now on. The D term of the U1 looks like this. And this is exactly the thing I wrote in the talk. So these C fields appear here. They have negative charge. This is a negative number. So this is essentially a positive term that looks like mod C squared. This Fi term is some constants. This is the volume of the Calabi-Yau in moduli. And this is the slope of the destabilizing subsheet. So it's negative in the supersymmetric region, zero on the line, positive in the non-stable region. You can write it out explicitly in terms of the Kähler moduli. These are topological numbers called the intersection numbers on the Calabi-Yau, the first Chern class of this destabilizing guy, and these are the moduli. And this reproduces all of the stuff that I claimed at the start of the talk. So when you're in the supersymmetric region, the slope of the destabilizing subsheet is negative, so the Fi term is negative. You can give a VEV to the C fields to cancel the Fi term. You can get D equals zero. You preserve supersymmetry. And in addition, you don't get a potential because the potential is D squared. If you're in the unstable region, the Fi term is positive. The other term is positive too. The D term cannot be canceled. You get supersymmetry breaking, and you get a potential which is D squared. So I'm just going to look at each of the regions in a bit more detail, and then I'll plot the potential for you so you can see what it looks like, although people have already mentioned. So let's first go into the supersymmetric region and see what happens to the spectrum. Well, when I go into the supersymmetric region, I have to give a BEV to these C fields to cancel the Fi term, but they're charged under the U1, so they're going to Higgs the U1 further, and very quickly they Higgs it above the compactification scale. So we go from E6 times U1 to E6 as the visible gauge field. Now, in fact, one of the CL fields gains a mass too. You can see that from the D term. So if I expand all my fields as VEV plus fluctuation and plug it into the D term, the pure VEV bit vanishes because the D term is zero. But the fluctuation bit stays and looks like this. It's just some linear combination of the fluctuations. And if you square this, it gives you a mass term for this particular linear combination of fields. So one of the combinations of Cs becomes massive. This is just the Higgs effect. This is the mass of a Higgs boson. This is the U1 being gauged. And the corresponding set of axions gets swallowed as the gauge boson becomes massive. So in the stable region, in the supersymmetric region, we end up with an E6 gauge group, which is correct. That reproduces the usual result for this bundle. We started with 16 of these C fields. We lose one, this Higgs effect, so we have 15. And we also have 7 bundle moduli that were there throughout. So this makes 22 moduli. And that's exactly, if you work in the supersymmetric region with the usual heterotic analysis, that precisely reproduces the usual number of bundle moduli. We've got 2 families in the 27 of E6, and that's also the right result. And so once you go into the supersymmetric region, you reproduce the usual analysis. So something Fernando said at the start is a very reasonable question, which is, has all of this just been accident? I've shown you one example. It could well have been that in other examples, I'd get both kinds of charge. Maybe the numbers wouldn't work out. But in the longer paper, we present formal proofs that this always works. You always reproduce the physical spectrum. If there is no stable bundle on the other side, you always only have one sign of CL charge. And as I said earlier, though, because we can use this sequence technology I showed you a little bit earlier on, those proofs don't even rely on how you constructed either the Calabi-Yau or the bundle. So if someone invents an entirely new way of constructing Calabi-Yau and bundles, it would still apply. So it works in general. Yeah, so what happens actually on the line is that the Higgs effect is going through the Kähler moduli. So one of the Kähler moduli becomes massive, and its associated axiom gets swallowed. And that's actually the usual heterotic Green-Schwarz anomalous U1. So what happens is, here's the Kähler modulus in this linear combination, and here are the C fields. And as you go away from, when you're on the line, this is zero. So you find that the thing that appears in the Higgs effect is the Kähler modulus. As you go away from the line, the relative size of these terms interchanges. This one becomes huge compared to this, and it effectively becomes a linear combination of the C fields. This goes, and that's what reproduces the usual spectrum. So in fact, wherever you are, there's always a very, very small admixture of the Kähler moduli mixed in. And if you trace back that what that means, you introduce matter fields into a heterotic compactification, it changes the definition of the 4D Kähler moduli. Yeah, so if you go off the line a long way, it's the C fields that get a mass, their axion, their phase, gets swallowed, and the Kähler moduli just become completely standard. Nothing's getting swallowed, nothing's getting pulled. Yeah, standard. So I'll just do the other two regions quickly. So on the line, what happens there? Well, the Fi term vanishes on the line. So you can still set the D term to zero, but you have to set the other term to zero as well, so the C field BEVs have to vanish. But remember, the C field BEVs, when they vanish, the bundle splits in two. So this is just the 4D description of what I showed you in the algebraic geometry, and it reproduces it correctly. As I say, one of the Kähler moduli is heavy in that discussion we just had. But then you can go into this unstable region, and now everything is specifically known, everything is a specific function for a given cloudy out. So you can actually plot what happens. So what I've done here is I've minimized the potential with respect to the C fields. So in the supersymmetric region, I've adjusted the C fields to set the potential to zero. The potential is minimized in the C direction by setting the C vevs to zero in the non-supersymmetric region, and I've just plotted the potential. So here in the supersymmetric region, you see it's nice and flat. But when you cross the line, this is the line where the bundle is no longer stable, a nice smooth potential just sweeps up. And this is an explicit enough function that you can plot it. So as we said, this is pushing you back into the supersymmetric region. It doesn't inflate, I checked. You can play around with this, and it's specific enough that you can do anything you want with it. I'm not going to discuss the mass spectrum because of our perturbative vacuum. So perturbatively, there isn't. But if you start to add in non-perturbative effects, maybe there is. Right? So this starts out arbitrarily smaller potential. So if you, one thing we were hoping is, say I put in a membrane instanton effect, so there's a small non-perturbative potential pushing me slightly up this wall. If you could get that to work, then what you would find is that you had a small-scale supersymmetry breaking, which is the playoff between the perturbative effect and this non-perturbative effect, and a stable vacuum, which would be very nice. And I can't get that to work. Can I? No, it's always U1. So we have cases where, in fact, the point you made earlier, that you could have several, it could split into several pieces, and that does happen, but that just means you get several new ones. Always have to go. Yeah, I mean, it just ends up looking like a menu. So that's basically the thing. I was going to tell you about higher order corrections, but given the time, I will spare you and skip that. Basically, there's some higher order corrections that sometimes people have talked about as corrections for stability. But it's just that you have to take into account the gauge fields live on one end of the heterotic N-theory orbifold, and the fields that you usually describe in supersymmetric theory are averages across the orbifold. If you take the difference into account, this picture is unchanged by corrections. Just to show you one picture very quickly, if you look at more complicated situations with one bundle that's stable in this region but unstable here, and a different bundle, completely different bundle that's stable here, but unstable here. If you write down the field theory on the line between them, you can find a very similar effect, but instead of having just one branch of vacua, which is the stable bundle, it has two different branches corresponding, the field theory has two different branches corresponding to the two different bundles. And you can actually, in this effect of field theory, smoothly roll between the different bundles in the heterotic theory. So what's previously been thought of as two separate compactifications of heterotic are actually smoothly connected in effective field theory. I can talk about that with people afterwards if they're interested. But given the time, I ought to finish up. So in conclusion, you can now describe this heterotic theory everywhere in the 4D, in the Kähler cone. I say everywhere because only, you know, I wrote this when I was thinking that you only have a 4D theory valid up to where the potential becomes too large. But as Cliff pointed out, there'll be some other theory, which is a non-supergravity theory, which will be valid in the other region. I haven't written that down, so that's not fine. But the real punchline is, when you go to the separation between these two regions, an extra U1 appears between the supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric regions, an extra U1 appears in the spectrum. It has a D term. It gives you the potential I've shown you. And all of this can be written down explicitly. And there's lots of further work that we've been doing on this sort of thing. So there's these complicated branch structures where you flip between different bundles. There's actually mathematical statements you can get out, because there's things that are obvious in the field theory that are really not obvious in the mathematics. So you would expect the stable regions from the mathematics to depend on complex structure. And the D term doesn't. So you think, well, maybe that's a contradiction. But when you build any bundle explicitly, which would give a supersymmetric theory, it just so happens magically that everything conspires so that stable regions don't depend on complex structure. We asked Ron Donaghy about it, since he didn't know this. So we've made a formal conjecture. He can find an example either. So we've made a conjecture that the mathematical trajectory to do with the regions of stability based on linking it to the field theory. Like I say, you could try and use this potential for moduli stabilization, Susie breaking, and so forth. If I've not been able to get that to work, I'm happy to tell people why if you're interested. You could try and get parts of bundle stability, which is nasty, but by just analyzing possible 4D effect field theories. And lastly, much as in the type 2 stuff that was mentioned at the start, when you break this U1, you often, well, you do get sort of remnants, discrete gauge remnants of it left at low energies, and they constrain things like the Carl couple. Now, seeing as just by the way you construct the bundle, you know that these extra U1s are there when you construct the bundle. This means that right at the start, when you construct your bundle in a heterotic theory, you can constrain the superpotential without having to calculate anything. And that's useful for building models. So that's all I was going to say, so thanks for listening.
Yeah, it is. It's a real shame. So remember I said that this potential does not depend on complex structure. So I've got some potential forcing this way, which does not depend on complex structure. And what I wanted to do was use membrane instantons to force them the other way. So if you try and use membrane instantons to force you the other way, the potential comes from W equals e to the minus t.
But in the potential, there's this e to the k factor out the front. And k includes the complex structure. So this potential that comes from this has some e to the minus 2t piece, but then it has 1 over, let me call the complex structure z. Z plus z bar squared. And what happens when you try and balance this is, first of all, it sits there and you're happy. Yeah, the z rolls away, turns off the potential, you end up back in the stable region. But if someone can fix that, then there's no reason why it can't work. Yeah, I'm not hugely familiar with this, but I know that I saw some talks recently by Anne Helleranger that's doing these wall crossing instabilities and stuff in touch with. Yeah. Oh, they've solved it there? Wow. Oh, I see. Yeah, of course, the trouble in heterotic is if you fix things by fluxes, then you end up in big trouble, right?